Good evening. Welcome to Profiles. My name is Bob Willard, and I'll be your host today as we visit with Joanne Folletta. Joanne is the music director of the Buffalo Philharmonic, the Virginia Symphony, and the Long Beach Symphony, amongst others. And she has won, now listen to this legacy, the Stokowski, Toscanini, and Bruno Walter Awards for conducting. And she's received numerous prizes for programming, including the American Symphony Orchestra League's John S. Edwards Award. Joanne's also a guitarist, and we're delighted to have you with us today. So thank you, Joanne, for coming.
Thank you, Bob. I'm delighted to be here.
Joanne, it seems that in the last, shall we say, 20 years, women in music in the United States have achieved a lot of new positions, yours in Buffalo and Virginia and Long Beach.
Yeah.
So what's happened? I mean, the Renaissance is pretty amazing.
Well, I think the time was right for change, Bob. That's what did it. I mean, up until maybe 25 years ago, one would never have thought of a woman composer or a woman conductor especially. But as orchestras started to change, you know, when we started to hold auditions behind a screen, we saw more and more women enter the orchestra itself. And I think that was the final catalyst for these other changes. As you know, the classical music world is very conservative. And it's never on the cutting edge of things. But I think as women entered other fields, law and medicine and business, all of a sudden there was a possibility. I know when I first went to school, to Manus College and Juilliard, there was still a little bit of skepticism about a woman seriously being a conductor. And I think I began to study just at the right time. If I'd started even 5 or 10 years earlier, it wouldn't have been possible.
And so it's just the evolution has worked in your favor.
Oh, yes.
Well, does it ever bother you to be called a female conductor rather than just a conductor without gender attached?
You know, I wouldn't say it bothers me, but I think that we will get to the point maybe in another 20 years where we won't be making that distinction. Same thing with composers. We won't be talking about women composers. We'll just simply be used to the concept enough that we won't make any distinction. So that's coming. You know, and the Women's Philharmonic was founded before I was there, of course, but it was founded to make the point that women can play in orchestras any instrument. So everyone was... We had only women in that orchestra playing tuba, playing trombone, playing percussion. And I think it did make a point. And, of course, it played music written by women. And that was probably its most important mission because at that point, when you looked at a symphony brochure anywhere, from Pasadena to the New York Philharmonic, you rarely, if ever, saw a piece written by a woman on the season. So the Women's Philharmonic was able to give performance hearings to women composers and allow them to develop. And that was the most exciting part of what we did.
Well, you've put out recordings by these people that aren't as familiar.
Yes. In fact, one of the interesting things we've done with Women's Philharmonic is we went back to the past and kind of researched and reworked in some cases pieces by names like Fanny Mendelssohn and Clara Schumann, Germaine Taillefer, women of the past who people were really not familiar with their music, and that was a special labor of love. As you can imagine, going to a library and digging out a piece by Fanny Mendelssohn in Berlin that had never been played since her lifetime required a lot of recopying and editing and forming the parts. But it enabled us to make the point that women have always been musicians, maybe not publicly accepted, but really wonderful musicians.
You've also given scholarships to conductors, females who wish to go into the conducting field, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
The organization,
the Women's Philharmonic, yes. And they continue to do that. I think their aim is to help women simply be the best musicians they can be.
Well, let's ask this question. What was it like when you stood up, and I assume that this would be more trouble in Europe maybe than it is here, in front of basically or truly an all-male orchestra? What was it like the first time?
You know, I think the most challenging time was when I conducted in Mannheim in Germany, which was 99% male. I think there were 2 or 3 women who were in there having their difficulties, but as members of the orchestra. And also the Mannheim Orchestra had a wonderful history. I mean, they were Mozart's favorite orchestra, so they had a very long history.
Wasn't Stamitz their music
director? That's right. Stamitz was their music director, yes. So the idea of a woman on the podium was one that they, you know, were not quite sure this was the next step to take. But it was wonderful that over the course of a week working with them, they seem to be able to come to a real feeling of comfort with it and acceptance. And in the times I've gone back there, it's been wonderful to go back as a friend. But it is quite daunting when you first encounter, you know, 100 people looking at you with mixed degrees of skepticism about, can this really be happening?
Well, anytime there's a first conductor, that skepticism is there. Now prove yourself.
That is,
but you
that's
add
right.
to it the gender difference. Mm-hmm. And is there a time when you sense that it's okay?
You know, that's a very interesting question. There really is. Now, in Europe, we get more rehearsals than we have in the U.S. We generally have 7 or 8 rehearsals there. We may have 3 or 4 here. And I think in a situation overseas, there comes a point in a rehearsal, whether it's the 3rd rehearsal or the 4th rehearsal, where I can actually feel the musicians forgetting about their reservations or letting go of their awareness of being conducted by a woman. And it's a very liberating time because you can just feel at that point they've said subconsciously, okay, it's fine. And then you can work in a way that's a little bit freer. But it takes a while for them to come to that point. Now, in the U.S., it's different. I think every orchestra spends maybe the first 10 or 15 minutes sizing up a conductor, if we could say it that way.
Testing you out,
yes,
right.
Deciding whether it's going to be a good week or not. Then they let go of that, and you can really just make music with them.
But there is a time when you sense that this has happened.
Yes. I can sense it now that there's just a period where they're feeling comfortable enough to let go of any preconceptions they might have had.
Just to carry this a little further, do you do standard repertoire with a new orchestra that you haven't conducted before, or do you bring in some of the things that you seem to be championing?
Well, I try, if I'm overseas, to at least bring one American piece. And generally, that's been very welcome. They like the idea of an American doing an American piece. Now, often overseas, their idea of an American piece is Gershwin, American in Paris. Which I've
like
done.
Copeland, yes.
Yes. Well, I've done those things a lot of times in Europe, and it's actually refreshing to see how much they love that music. They just love it. We almost take Gershwin for granted in our country, Bob. You know, oh, we're doing right. the American in Paris again. But for an orchestra in Germany, an orchestra in Spain, to do the American in Paris is a treat, and their seriousness and their affection for this music is very inspiring to me. I remember, again, what a treasure we have in our own composers. But I generally bring an American piece if I can, and when I'm guest conducting in the States, I like to bring a piece of new music if I can. My feeling is that really as a conductor, as an American conductor, I have a responsibility, and it's a privilege, too, to help American composers have a voice in the orchestral world, not to let the orchestra become just a museum of 19th century work, but to go forward and to show that the orchestra is continually evolving with people like Joan Tower or John Luther Adams, or lots of young people writing great music.
Who would you say that are some of the composers that you've done a lot? I mean, you've mentioned Joan Tower. And
I've done Joan a lot. I'm trying to think. There are names that would be unfamiliar, but I've done John Adams a lot of the Chairman dances,
yes,
that we're doing. Corigliano is a wonderful composer. Ellen Zwillich, really a great composer. There are so many, and Claude Baker that we're doing on our concert on Wednesday. A magnificent composer, and there are just so many people like that who should be played more and more and should become staples of the concert repertoire.
Well, it's interesting. When I look through your discography, I see a lot of unusual names.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, there's the one you made with Long Beach with Debussy and Liadov.
Well, yes. And that was a little bit of a treat for me because I had made a lot of discs, as you say, with unusual repertoire, either repertoire by women of the past or contemporary composers or unknown composers like Jerome Ross, wonderful American voices of the past.
Well, we just think of him as Big Country or
Rawhide. Yes, yeah. But in Long Beach, we wanted to make a disc that really captured what life was about in Long Beach, in Southern California, living on the coast. And the image of the sea, of course, was the one that really informs our entire life there, as you know. So that it seemed natural to include music about the sea. And it was a delight to do La Mer and the Frank Bridge, The Sea, which is a piece that very few people know.
Well, that was Britten's teacher, wasn't he?
That's right. That's right. And this is a wonderful work, and Britten especially loved this work. And Frank Bridge's orchestration is magnificent. So,
You might just touch a little bit about the instrumentalists you get in Long Beach. I don't want to dwell on it, but where they come from.
Well, it's an unusual orchestra in Long Beach because it's not full-time. We enjoy their wonderful talents generally once a month, and the rest of the time they are spending their time in the recording studios. So when you go and hear Titanic or new John Williams film or the new Star Wars film, those are Long Beach Symphony musicians in their other life as studio musicians. And it's been wonderful for us because they make the bulk of their income in the studios, which is very lucrative work for them. But they still love to come once a week and play Shostakovich or Prokofiev or Mahler because that's to them the kind of music that they dreamed about playing when they were studying music in the conservatory. So it's the best of both worlds for them, and it's thrilling to work with musicians of that quality.
Well, they can sight read anything.
Anything. It's amazing. Absolutely astounding. I mean, there are very few places in the country that have musicians who become so skilled in that art.
We've talked a while. Why don't we listen to some music? And we have a number of things that you've performed on or conducted, and so what would you say would be nice to listen to now?
Well, what we might do is, since we talked about Long Beach and about the musicians of Long Beach, why don't we listen to a movement from Frank Bridge, The Sea?
We have just heard a movement from The Sea by Frank Bridge, a turn-of-the-century English composer, conducted by our guest today, Joanne Folletta, with the Long Beach Symphony. Could you tell us a little bit more about this piece of music?
Well, we think it's a very happy discovery because Bridge is not a name that's that well known. He's probably best known for being Benjamin Britten's teacher. This is a piece, I think, that illustrates his tremendous skill with the palette of the orchestra. You can almost hear the crashing waves in his music. It's incredible. So we included it on our disc about music of the sea, and the reaction from people who are hearing Bridge for the first time has been very favorable.
And you programmed him?
Yes.
Good. Let's follow your history a little bit. You were born in Queens. Mm-hmm. You got your PhD in guitar, and now you conduct all over the world.
Well, it's a strange background.
Can you sort of give us a flow from, you know?
Well, I think I was very lucky that my parents were very great music lovers. They weren't musicians. So they started my sister and myself early on studying music, and my first instrument at 7 was guitar. So classical guitar always had a very special place in my life. I find it a wonderful foil to conducting the symphony because it's so intimate, it's so personal, and it's for me a very wonderful way of expressing myself that's very different than relying on 100 different people to work with you. I continue to study music all my life. In fact, I really can't remember a time when I didn't know I was going to be a musician. That's been the focus of my life, and I had a chance to study piano and cello as well, and then went to Manus College of Music as a double major in classical guitar and orchestral conducting, and then went on to Juilliard and concentrated on conducting from that point on. So I actually got my DMA from Juilliard, and I feel so privileged that opportunities began to open up for me. I just feel incredibly lucky that after studying in New York, I was able to start working with the Denver Chamber Orchestra, really while I was still a student. Worked with the Women's Philharmonic in San Francisco and as associate conductor with the Milwaukee Symphony, and Long Beach, of course, when I was appointed music director, and then Virginia Symphony, and now Buffalo. So it's been unusual twists and turns. I never would have imagined when I was growing up living in Buffalo or Milwaukee or Long Beach, But they've been wonderful, wonderful opportunities for me. And I think the steps have been good ones in that I've been challenged by the level of musicians with whom I've been working, and I've learned a great deal from them.
From what you've just said, it sounded to me like you determined to be a conductor very early on.
You know, I did, Bob. I was determined to be a conductor from, I guess, the time I was 11 or 12. And I think that was really largely because I went to a lot of concerts. We grew up in New York, so we went to Carnegie Hall a great deal. And I remember being thrilled by the symphony as a young girl. The idea, watching those people working to make something beautiful happen, I'd look at their faces and notice how different they all were. But for those 2 hours, they were completely focused on creating something beautiful. And that impressed me. And I remember leaving the concert hall after a Beethoven 6, after Mussorgsky pictures at an exhibition, just feeling like I was floating out of the hall. I was so uplifted somehow by it. And I thought, if I could do that, if I could make someone feel like I felt, what better thing to do with my life? So I made up my mind very early, and I think I must have been one of the most naive children ever, because it never occurred to me that I did not see a woman on the podium when I was going to all those concerts. It just never occurred to me. And my parents, not being professional musicians, didn't make that connection either. So I didn't hear until I was about 16 or 17 expressed by conservatories that I was talking to that conducting for a woman, orchestral conducting for a woman, was a very, you know, not traveled path. And it might be difficult. But at that point, I had my heart set on this. So I persisted, and I was very fortunate that both of those schools were willing to take a chance, and it really was chancy at that time.
Well, the tradition of conducting in Juilliard is pretty exceptional.
It was an extraordinary program. A very small class. We had at the most 6 people in our class during the time I was studying there, and we had our own orchestra, the conductor's orchestra, with whom we worked. They might have been a little bit difficult to handle, but you can imagine working as a young conductor, just really learning your craft, with experts sitting in front of you, violinists who've been playing since they were 4 or 5 and, you know, not really sure.
Are they also students?
Students. Okay. All students. It was a very challenging place to learn, and that was good for us because we had to work with excellent musicians. We had to learn how to be leaders. We had to learn how to work with them, to inspire them. We had to learn what to say and how to say it. And we had access to wonderful teachers like Sixten Ehrling and George Mester there. And one of the most exciting things was that Leonard Bernstein would come in periodically and work with us. And that was always a thrill. The moment he entered the room, it seemed, Bob, that he was kind of an electrical presence. And physically, when you saw him, you'd be surprised at how short he was. He was very, very small of stature, maybe about 5'4", I'm guessing. He had a very large head, smoked constantly. I mean, Juilliard would, of course, waive the no-smoking rule when he came because he always smoked. But he'd walk into the room and everyone would just sit up. I mean, something happened. And he was very generous working with young conductors, very kind, very giving, and very, very loving, really, in a way. And then the real treat for the orchestra was at the end of the session where he'd helped us work on our pieces. He would conduct our conductor's orchestra. It was always amazing to my colleagues and myself that, you know, we struggled with them because they could never follow us. You know, we'd try and be so clear, and they'd still not understand where our downbeat was. And Bernstein wasn't known for clarity. You know, he'd begin conducting Mahler II, and we'd wonder how this orchestra was understanding what he was doing. But nonetheless, they did. They were able to play beautifully for him because there was something about his musicianship that communicated itself to them. It was wonderful to see that.
From there?
Well, I started, you know, growing up in New York, I had this terrible attitude. I'm embarrassed to admit it now, that many New Yorkers have, that, you know, New York is the center of the music world, and that's all I knew until I was invited to become the music director of the Denver Chamber Orchestra, and all of a sudden, a whole world of music opened itself up to me. The idea that in Denver, in Milwaukee, in San Francisco, in Long Beach, in Virginia, that there was great music making all over the country and wonderful places to live. And I was delighted. I felt that all of a sudden I understood what our country was about. And it was a wonderful privilege to be able to work in those cities. So now I've sort of left myself open to whatever path will present itself, because all of those unexpected turns in my career were really blessings for me, because I learned so much from them.
Were you always comfortable being in front of people? It would seem to me like that's a real important...
Conducting helped me become comfortable. It's funny, as a child, I was very, very shy, almost to the point where, you know, playing guitar and practicing my music was the only way I could express myself. I found it very, very difficult to be communicative with people. And I guess a lot of people are shy like that. But it really wasn't until I began to conduct and began to work with orchestras that I was able to communicate to them, because I understood that that was my role, that I had to do that. And I've learned from that experience, too. And I think that while basically I still feel at the core like a shy person, in making music with musicians, I've been able to get past that.
Well, I remember seeing you on a children's concert on television that you were doing, I think, with the New York Philharmonic or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you seemed perfectly at ease. I mean, it seemed very
well.
Nice.
You know, I always say talking about music and being with people who love music makes me feel at ease.
Okay. So the music has been your avenue in a way.
Oh, yes. And I think that now more and more music directors are doing pre-concert talks. And I know that... I've done them, of course, in Long Beach and Virginia, and we'll do them in Buffalo. And that's been a wonderful way of communicating with audiences who want to know more about what they're going to hear. So an hour before each concert, I spend half an hour telling them what's in store for them and what the piece means to us as musicians and what we are trying to communicate and what it might have meant to the composer. And that's been a wonderful way of opening the door.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's what you talked about.
Yes, yes. And that makes me feel so happy when people in the audience feel that they are successful in understanding. Because that's one of the problems with American audiences. They're fearful about not knowing enough. And not being experts, or clapping in the wrong place, or not understanding a work, or not understanding the program notes, and sometimes the pre-concerts can break that down and say, you know, everyone takes something different away from this performance. There's nothing right or wrong. It's simply what you feel when you listen to the music.
Do you still play the guitar?
I still do. I limit my playing now really to chamber music. Especially with members of the orchestra, and those were with some members of the Virginia Symphony that we did a concert at the Waterfront Festival in Virginia. And it's really fun for me, as you can imagine, to work with members of the orchestra in a different setting, in a chamber music setting, to get to know them as people in a different way and to make music with a little circle of three or four people rather than with 95 people sitting there. So I find that so much fun now, and I had a great time with that.
Is it just guitar, or do you play other instruments?
Well, I play lute, too. And those are the instruments that I've kept up, because they were the ones that I started with, and to me they feel the most personal. Very recently I had the first disc come out of with me as a guitarist on it, which I never would have dreamed would ever have happened.
But, I know we're segueing right into that.
We'll play a little section of that.
Why don't we do it? What do we have here?
Why don't we play a movement from a Beethoven trio? This is a trio by Beethoven, originally composed for violin, viola, and cello, but immediately arranged by a contemporary of Beethoven named Mattiega for flute, clarinet, and guitar. Thank you.
We have just heard our guest, Joanne Folletta, playing the guitar. Now, could you tell us a little bit more about this piece? Beethoven,
well,
right?
I don't think people realize that contemporary music in the past was so popular. For instance, when Beethoven wrote a piece of chamber music, the practice was that other musicians would then rearrange it for different combinations of instruments because it would sell like hotcakes. And that's exactly what happened. Beethoven's trio for violin, viola, and cello was so popular that it was rearranged for different groups. And one of the most beautiful was by the guitarist Matiega, the 19th century guitarist Matiega, who rearranged Beethoven's work for flute, clarinet, and guitar. And I think changed, of course, the color of the piece, but in a very charming way, and it was a real delight for me to be able to record that work.
Keep you getting your licks in that way.
Right? That's right.
You've taken orchestras that have been in some sense of disarray, Long Beach, Virginia, and Buffalo. And what is it that helps you change them around? Boom, it's different.
It takes a tremendous commitment. If you, I think any American music director of American orchestra has to know when they take that position, it's a great deal more than conducting rehearsals and concerts. It's really an emotional commitment to do whatever is necessary to strengthen your organization. And a lot of that has to do with communication, being willing to talk to the public, being willing to go to the schools, being willing to work with your staff, your marketing people, your development people, to strategize and put together a plan of how we can strengthen who we are, how we can refine who we are. What's the mission? I mean, you've got to be willing to ask the hard questions. What is the mission of our organization? Are we doing what we should? Are we serving the community? If not, how can we? And the music director has to be willing to ask those hard questions and to do a tremendous amount of research and planning into making the orchestra stronger. And it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, you can't come in and do it in 6 months. I mean, you've got to make a 3-4 year commitment before you start seeing changes. And what's been wonderful for me in those troubled situations is seeing the community embrace the orchestra. The community that might have been a little skeptical. Oh, they're always having financial problems. Oh, they're, you know, in the red again. But to see them all of a sudden have a sense of pride in their organization and in what it means for their community, that has been thrilling for me, and it's happened. But it takes tremendous work to do that, and yet it's tremendously satisfying. You know, I guest conduct a lot, and I find that guest conducting is really a lot of fun, Bob, as you can imagine, because you go into a situation, you have no responsibilities other than making music, those 4 or 5 rehearsals and the concerts, and it's wonderful. You don't have to worry about payroll or, you know, how are the ticket sales going or, you know, the planning for next season. None of that. You just have fun as a musician working with the orchestra. And that's delightful. But in the long run, what's the most satisfaction is seeing your own orchestra have an increased presence in a community and an increased value where people are excited about what's happening. And there's nothing like that, to see the Long Beach community rally around an orchestra that was basically defunct maybe 12, 13 years ago. To see the Virginia Symphony, to see the community in Hampton Roads, Virginia, in that southeastern part of the state, all of a sudden be amazed by their orchestra, by the fact that it could go to Carnegie Hall and get great reviews in the New York press, and to welcome them back. That kind of thing, making an impact on a community, I think is the most satisfying thing I've ever done.
Going to Carnegie Hall or building the orchestra?
Building an orchestra and making it have even more value in a community.
And their belief that they are good enough to play in Carnegie Hall.
That's right. That's right. I think it amazed everybody. And it was a high point for that organization to go to Carnegie for the first time in its 70-year history and to come back and to be able to say to the community, you can be proud of us. We represented you on perhaps the greatest stage in the country. We represented our community. And that's when you know an orchestra is thriving, when it's just as important to the community as the Buffalo Bills. It's just as important. And that's what we have to strive for in this country. We have to make sure that our cultural organizations are that intrinsic to life in our cities and in our towns.
So when they get you, they get more than just a stick wielder.
Well, I think my responsibility is much more than that. And I will tell you, that's not something you learn in school. I remember the first real job I had with the Denver Chamber Orchestra. We'd never, ever in Juilliard discussed what a music director did. Not a word. All we knew was how to conduct an orchestra and study scores. And then to be faced with helping with budgets or speaking at the Lions Luncheon and devising a youth program, all of these things one learns on the job. And it can be very daunting. I wish there was a way that schools could somehow prepare young conductors for being music directors, because that's the only way our cultural life in this country is going to be strengthened.
Well, you got a business, you got to sell a product, and that's what you're doing.
That's right.
But you're the CEO in this case, and at least of the product.
That's right. That's right.
In achieving the successes you have, there have been mentors, heroines, spiritual guides, people who have stood for things. And I wondered if you could share who those people might be and what they gave to you.
Well, I always have to say, first off, the two teachers that I studied the most with, I will always be grateful to, and I have tremendous love for both of them. That's Sixten Ehrling and George Mester. And both of those men were dealing with a woman as a student for the first time. I mean, they really, you know, had not much background in this, but both of them had faith that this could happen. And I'm so grateful to the two of them. I mean, they were both very different individuals, Sixten Ehrling being a really the old school maestro and George being much more progressive, but fabulous musicians. And I think I learned so much of what I know from the two of them. And Bernstein, of course, having the opportunity to study with him, maybe not every day, but having the opportunity to work with him at Juilliard was astounding. And I think he couldn't help but be a tremendous influence on every American musician because, frankly, Bob, he was the first American conductor who was accepted around the world, perhaps the only American conductor who's ever been embraced as a great musician everywhere. So for us as American students, that meant a great deal. It was an example that our country could produce musicians of whom they could be proud. And that was tremendous. And I find that I learn now the most from actually the musicians and orchestras where I work. And, you know, that maybe they're not aware of that. I don't know. But every time I get on the podium, whether it's a rehearsal or a concert, I am learning so much, or listening to an oboe play a melody and phrase it in a way that I hadn't heard before, listening to what a string section, the sound a string section can produce, and having them nonverbally teach you so much. Working with a great pianist and accompanying someone like André Michel Schub or Horacio Gutierrez and learning, again, nonverbally, a level of musicianship that is so stunning. I feel so fortunate because how many other professions can you know every single day that you're going to learn something wonderful about your profession? And there's so much learning ahead. And I think that's the most wonderful thing about being a conductor. You never stop learning. And when you're doing, let's say, Beethoven Fifth for the first time, it's fabulous to do it for the first time. When you're doing it for the 25th time, you've learned so much more. And it's not only that you're doing it for the 25th time, it's also that you, maybe in those 10 years, have become a different person. You've learned more about people. You've learned more about life in general. So when you look at that score, it's with a different sensibility that you look at it. And 10 years in the future, it will be different.
I noticed that George Mester seems to be in your life a lot.
I am a great fan of George's. I think he's one of the most superb conductors I've ever seen, and a beautiful person as well. And George helped me in a particularly special way at Juilliard because he was very, very insightful about psychological differences between a woman on the podium and a man on the podium, and how women use their authority or undermine their authority in ways that men don't struggle with. So my years with him, as you can imagine, were very painful, very challenging, but he helped me see that I had to find ways to use authority that were comfortable for me, that perhaps my male colleagues didn't have to struggle with.
Can you give us an example of that?
Well, George would mention, and he studied my behavior on the podium in absolute detail, that, for instance, a male colleague might say to the orchestra, let's play letter C again, or play letter C again. And I would say, please, let's take it from letter C one more time. And even in the subtlety of that language, there might be some undermining of security and authority. Or he would notice that when a male colleague was addressing the clarinetist saying, you know, you're sharp on your A, I would tend to look at my score instead of addressing the person by looking at him. Again, a subtle body language that undermined authority. So he helped me realize that as a conductor, it was not my right to be demanding, but it was my responsibility to be demanding, that the orchestra needed that, wanted that, and required that. But I had to be sure of what I wanted and to be able to express it with authority in whatever way felt comfortable for me. I've seen men on the podium who are very gentle, men who are very dictatorial, but it works as long as it's natural to them. And I think that's the most important thing about a conductor's presence. You have to have authority, but you have to be yourself at the same time.
And it's all about making the music.
Absolutely. That's exactly it, Bob. It's all about making the music. It's not about being the great maestro. It's not about how the audience is going to admire the gesture that you make to the cellos. It's all about the music, and it's about creating a framework in which the musicians can play beautifully, because that's your instrument. You're not imposing anything on them. You really, as a conductor, should be buoying them up. You should be allowing them the flexibility and the freedom to give 100% of their musical talent, not strangling them, but opening the door for them. And that's the ideal that I think conductors should aspire to.
You seem to have the ability to take risks. You've tried new things where others may not. Where did that come from?
You know, I don't know, but I think I've been so intrigued, I think, and excited by new ideas. Some of it might have come from the Women's Philharmonic, and maybe I should credit them, because when I went to San Francisco, I was working with the Milwaukee Symphony as their associate, doing very traditional repertoire all the time. And I got a call from the Women's Philharmonic in San Francisco, and they said, we specialize in music by women, and we'd like to talk to you. And I remember my comment to them, and I'm embarrassed to say it now. I said, what music by women? Can you imagine? This is a woman. And it was because my background at Manus and at Juilliard had been completely traditional. We never studied a piece by a woman. We never even talked about a piece by a woman. And they said, come out, please. Let us show you what we've been doing. And I went out there. And in my week there, I discovered a vast library of pieces by women of the past and the present. And I was enthralled by it. And I decided that I wanted to learn about this. So in the 10 years I spent there, I did so many world premieres. And when you're doing world premieres, you have to take risks. You don't know. You commission a piece, you don't know what you're going to get. There's no tradition of it. There's no, yeah, this is going to be a hit. Like we know if we do Beethoven 7th, this is going to be a hit. We don't know. We had to take those chances. We had to do new things. And in doing that, I think I just developed an appetite and a curiosity about new music or unusual music that then led me to look for something like the Frank Bridge in Long Beach or other works like that that are not in the mainstream repertoire. And I feel I've been rewarded 100-fold by these discoveries of great music that I can then bring to audiences.
You're like the guide dog.
Yeah. Researching it out. And, you know, taking risks, as you know, doesn't always yield fruit. That happens. But I think it's exciting to be in the position where you can be making discoveries and you can be exposing people to new works that maybe not all are going to be masterpieces, but we're involved in the process.
If a young woman came to you and said she wanted to be a conductor, what advice would you give her?
To be totally sure that that's what she wanted, because I think you've got to do a lot of trailblazing still as a conductor, male or female. There is no way of, in our country, of apprenticeship. you really forge your own way, whether it's starting your own orchestra or becoming an assistant to someone or taking a job at a university and learning your craft. You have to be totally sure. And to be prepared to work very, very hard. It's the most rewarding profession possible, I think. And what I generally say is if someone comes to me and says, I'm not sure I want to be a musician or a doctor, then they should be a doctor. Because most musicians know always that they're going to be musicians. It's almost as if there's not a choice, Bob. They never make a choice. And I'm not only speaking for myself, I'm speaking for people in the orchestras that I work with. They never consciously make a choice. They just know from the moment they pick up the instrument or a little later on as a 9-year-old or a 10-year-old that this is who they are. They are they're a violinist. They're a guitarist. They're a composer. They never question that. You need that kind of dedication, I think, to be able to be an artist in any profession because there are a lot of challenges and sacrifices. And there's also the sense that you're never there. You're constantly learning more and working harder. You can never say, now I'm a conductor. At least I don't think you should say that. You have to say, okay, I've gotten a little closer to the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances. I understand a little bit better this time, but I'm going to keep working on it, and next time I'm going to be able to understand a little bit more. It's as if we get closer and closer to the center of a piece, but we never reach it. And in that never reaching it is the whole challenge of our lives.
I'm going to ask a sexist question. What does a female conductor wear?
A lot of people ask that question, Bob. It is something that comes up a lot because there is no standard garb. I tend to change what I wear depending on where I am. In the States, when I conduct in the States, I almost always wear a black tuxedo suit, you know, with pants and a black jacket. Because frankly, that's the most comfortable garb. You don't have to be conscious of what you're wearing. Audiences are used to seeing that. Frankly, you blend in with the orchestra so that people are not distracted by some, you know, color or fabric or motion that they're not used to. I mean, our whole aim is to really be invisible so that we can bring the music out. But when I conduct in Europe, I almost always wear a skirt with a jacket. And the funny thing is overseas, they sometimes make strange associations between women wearing trousers and women wearing skirts, and they feel a little bit more comfortable with the idea of a woman not pretending to be a man, as they say. You don't need to pretend to be a man. And with them, wearing trousers does that. So I found that in Europe, in Mexico, it's more comfortable wearing a skirt and a jacket. But mostly in the United States, at least now, it's very comfortable wearing pants. I remember maybe even 12 years ago in Texas having a manager ask me to be sure not to wear pants. Because in that community in Texas, it was not going to go over well. It's really reversed itself. Occasionally, when I will wear a skirt in a community here in the United States, they'll say, oh, but we wanted to see your tuxedo. So hopefully people don't pay much attention to it beyond the first 5 minutes of the concert. One of the great compliments that I've gotten is people say to me after the concert, you know, after 10 minutes or so, I completely forgot you were a woman. And they don't know what to make of that, and they're almost afraid to say that. But to me, that's a great compliment because it meant that all of a sudden they weren't thinking about people. They were thinking about Beethoven, or they were thinking about Joan Tower, or they were thinking about Dvorak, and that's what we want.
If you had a list of the code of ethics or beliefs, or what have been your guiding principles in life, could you deliberate on them?
Well, I think there are a couple of things that I feel very strongly about, and one you articulated, sir, very beautifully, and that is the main thing at the core is the music. And that's the only reason why we are here, is to bring this incredible legacy that we have to life. And we have to be 100% true to what that composer wanted and to the idea of making beautiful music. The ego, the I in that, has nothing to do with it. It's the music that's at the core of it. And I think another principle that has helped me, particularly in some situations that have been challenging, has been to expect the best from people and to give people the complete benefit of the doubt, to expect the best. I find that sometimes people go in saying, well, I knew they weren't going to like me because I'm a woman, or I knew they weren't going to like me because I'm American or because I'm young or whatever. And in being prepared for that, you really can't do your best. So I found to get on every podium and to expect the very best musical and professional behavior from people has paid off, because people, when they know that you expect a great deal from them, generally rise to the occasion. And I found that that's been very, very inspiring, especially in situations where there might be some skepticism about how is this going to go.
Now we know why those orchestras have thrived after you've been there.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Okay. Well, we thank you for being here. Now, let's hear one final piece. We only got a few moments. What would you suggest?
Let's play something from our Virginia Symphony Carnegie debut, because that was a very significant moment.
Sure.
In our development. We went there with an American piece, and I'm very proud of that. So we might hear the Samuel Barber First Symphony.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure, Bob.
Our guest today has been Joanne Folletta. She's here in Bloomington, and we're delighted she took time out to visit with us.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in July of 1999. Christina Kuzmich, producer. Engineering and editing by Michael Pazkash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.